Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Donald Trump is expected to announce his Middle East peace deal, and he has also met with Benjamin Netanyahu, who has now been charged and facing corruption. Our guest is Phyllis Bennis. Also, we get an update on the impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump, the book of Bolton causing waves across Washington, D.C. and in the hearing itself. Also, there is a movement for a stamp to remember Bayard Rustin, the controversial civil rights leader who was sidelined, many say, because he was gay. And we're also going to just briefly pause to remember not only Kobe Bryant and his daughter, but all of those killed in the horrific helicopter crash that took place in Southern California on Sunday. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Trump's legal team wraps up its argument in his Senate trial today. Yesterday, his defense ignored the firestorm over revelations in a soon-to-be-published book by former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Bolton writes that Trump wanted him to withhold military aid from Ukraine until it committed to helping with investigations into rival Joe Biden. Trump brushed off the report.
Well, I haven't seen a manuscript, but I can tell you nothing was ever said to John Bolton, but I have not seen a manuscript. I guess he's writing a book. I have not seen it.
Bolton's assertion matters because Trump and his lawyers have repeatedly insisted he never tied the suspension of military aid to political investigations. It also gave weight to the Democratic demand that Bolton be called as a witness in the trial. Democratic Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff is the lead House prosecutor.
We could not have made a more powerful case for calling him than the case the president's lawyers just did in trying to contest that link between military aid investigations. So once again, they underscored the importance of John Bolton as a witness who would corroborate exactly what the uncontested evidence that the House put on shows, that President Trump used hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid to coerce an ally to conduct these political sham investigations.
For their part, Trump's attorney said there was no basis to remove Trump from office, defended his actions as appropriate, and assailed Biden. The legal team argued that Trump had legitimate reasons to be suspicious of Hunter Biden's business dealings and concerned about corruption in Ukraine. A divided U.S. Supreme Court has ruled 5-4 to allow the Trump administration to put in place new rules that could jeopardize permanent resident status for immigrants who use food stamps, Medicaid, or housing vouchers. Under the new policy, immigration officials can deny green cards to legal immigrants over their use of public benefits. Roughly 544,000 people apply for green cards annually. According to the government, 382,000 are in categories that would make them subject to the new review. California Governor Gavin Newsom denounced the decision. He said its effect will be devastating. Newsom said because of the rule, families already are going hungry and people are avoiding needed medical care. The California governor said the state will continue to fight what he called these efforts to terrorize immigrant families. Israel's attorney general formally has indicted Benjamin Netanyahu on corruption charges after the prime minister withdrew his request for parliamentary immunity. Netanyahu may have been hoping the dramatic events in Israel will be overshadowed by what President Trump is calling the deal of the century. The supposed plan for peace between Israel and the Palestinians will be unveiled today. It was developed without participation of the Palestinians, who have rejected it in advance. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat.
This is actually the fraud of the century. The fraud of the century. not its deal, canceling everything relating to international law and international legitimacy.
Netanyahu has hailed the plan as a chance to make history and define Israel's final borders. His political challenger, Benny Gantz, has spoken in glowing terms about Trump and his initiative. A key question will be whether the proposal includes U.S. support for any Israeli annexation of the occupied West Bank. In the run-up to Israel's March 2nd election, Netanyahu has called for annexing parts of the West Bank and imposing Israeli sovereignty on all its settlements there. The settlements are illegal under international law. A federal appeals court hears arguments today in three lawsuits opposing President Trump's travel ban on mostly Muslim countries. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the administration's ban in 2018, but plaintiffs claim that the Supreme Court ruling was narrow. They say it only rejected a preliminary injunction to block the travel ban and did not consider the merits of the constitutional challenge to it. Meantime, nearly every Democratic House member has signed on to legislation that would overturn the ban on travelers from Syria, Somalia, Yemen, Libya, Iran, North Korea, and some officials from Venezuela. Los Angeles Democratic Congresswoman Judy Chu co-sponsored the legislation called the No Ban Act. She says the Supreme Court ruling upholding the ban included a requirement the Trump administration grant waivers to people who go through a stringent vetting process. Chu says the administration is not complying with the waiver procedure.
All of that is why, in addition to repealing all three Muslim bans, the No Ban Act requires a president to demonstrate an actual threat before issuing such a ban. And that means if the president believes our existing vetting system is not working, he would have to demonstrate that the 90% of an entire country, which happens to be majority Muslim, is too dangerous to be here.
The Trump administration is expected to add more countries to the travel ban soon. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Before we go to our first segment, we are going to pause, as we do in the tradition of Sojourner Truth, to remember Kobe Bryant, his daughter, her friends, two other 13-year-olds, and all of those killed in the horrific helicopter crash that took place this past Sunday in Southern California. Kobe Bryant was 41 years old. We all know that he, although an incredible global sports icon and star and very much a hero in Southern California, where he played for the Lakers for 20 seasons. He was 41 years old, by the way, when he died, that he was also imperfect. And many are uncomfortable at this time of his death to raise the charges that were brought against him by a 19-year-old who claimed that Kobe Bryant raped her. Kobe apologized for being basically stepping outside of his marriage. That very much remains a cloud over Kobe Bryant. Nevertheless, one cannot deny the contributions that he made to sport and to baseball. And he was indeed on his way to his daughter's team. And he had to work with young people, young girls in particular, who wanted to play basketball. So we are now going to play the morning song that is sung in Dida by Nafriki.
Yeah, oh, Goloka.
Okay, and the morning song, remembering all of those who were killed, Kobe Bryant, his daughter, and all of the others who were killed this past Sunday. We are now going to turn our attention to, well, Donald Trump says he's solved the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and he is expected in a couple of hours to unveil his so-named peace plan, which he claims will help to bring an end to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Let us go to a clip now of Trump talking about this.
It's a plan that Bibi and his opponent, I must say, have to like very much. And I can say in terms of Bibi, he does. And I think in terms of his opponent, he does too. I'll be meeting with him in a little while. But this is a plan that's very important to peace in the Middle East. No matter where I went, they say Israel and the Palestinians, they have to make peace before you can really have peace in the Middle East. So people have been working on this for many, many years, and I think we're relatively close, but we have to get other people to agree with it also. I will say many of the Arab nations have agreed to it. They like it. They think it's great. They think it's a big start. I think it's a big start, too. I think it's a fantastic thing if we can pull it off. They say it's probably the most difficult deal anywhere and of any kind to make.
All righty. And Donald Trump also refused to address a reporter's question about whether he consulted with the Palestinians about his plan, saying they probably won't want it initially, but in the end they will. Meanwhile, the Palestinian authorities has called for a boycott, and they are pressing leaders in the region not to participate, ambassadors of Arab nations not to attend today's unveiling of the plan. But reports have circulated that Gulf monarchies like Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations allied with the United States, like Jordan, will offer tacit support for the plan. Now, today's meeting comes, the context of it, of course, of Trump's impeachment trial and the explosive news about John Bolton in his book, pretty much confirming what the Democrats have said about Donald Trump and the charges he is facing in the impeachment trial. And they're also coming at a time that Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, the Israeli prime minister, has been charged with bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in three separate corruption cases. And indeed, today in the Jerusalem District Court, shortly after Benjamin Netanyahu made a move, he thought a clever move, withdrawing his request for parliamentary immunity. He knew he was not going to get it, so he withdrew it. But an indictment was submitted to the Jerusalem District Court today. So we'll be following that very closely. Now, if convicted, Netanyahu must resign. Donald Trump met not only with Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington, D.C., but also his opponent in the upcoming election, the legislative election, which will take place on March the 2nd, Benny Gantz. Now, Gantz has also offered support for Donald Trump's peace plan, calling it a significant and historic milestone. Now, here to break all of this down for us, we'd like to welcome back Middle East expert Phyllis Bennis. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, focusing on U.S. Middle East and war policy. Her most recent books include Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict and Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. Phyllis Bennis, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
So, Phyllis, your assessment on this and what's going on?
Well, this is not, whatever else it is, it is not an Israeli-Palestinian deal. This is a U.S.-Israeli deal. This meeting today is a meeting of the impeached and the indicted, if you will. I don't anticipate that anyone really thinks that peace had anything to do with this. This was about providing legal and political protection to keep Trump in the White House and Bibi Netanyahu out of jail. And get both of them reelected in the meantime. So this was a thoroughly political arrangement with domestic consequences in the U.S. and Israel far more important than anything that happens on the ground. I don't anticipate that there will be a significant change of anything on the ground. What it does is to consolidate and provide a U.S. imprimatur, U.S. legitimacy, U.S. official protection to Israel in its series of violations of international law, of human rights. And I think that what we're seeing is that this emerges in the context of a series of gifts that Trump has already provided to Netanyahu. This is in the broader context, of course, of decades of a thoroughly pro-Israeli, anti-Palestinian set of policies by the United States. This isn't new. Trump didn't reverse a supposedly even-handed policy in the U.S. role in Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. There never was an even-handed U.S. position. It was always acting, as Aaron David Miller said in his book, one of the longtime negotiators, who continues, as of even an hour ago, appearing on NPR as a continued expert in these things, despite his 25 years of failure, along with Martin Indyk and the others, to say that the U.S. acted as Israel's lawyer. That hasn't changed, except that it's become significantly more explicit under Trump. And the gifts that Trump has provided through his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to the Israelis, and specifically to Bibi Netanyahu and the right-wing, the far-right-wing coalition government, that include, just in these 2.5 years that Trump has been in office, recognition of Jerusalem as the sole capital of Israel only, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing Israeli occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights as somehow legitimate, announcing that settlements suddenly are not in violation of international law, ending the funding of UNRWA, the UN agency that provides support for Palestinian refugees throughout the region, cutting funding to all Palestinian humanitarian projects, including hospitals, closing the PLO office in Washington, accepting the new nation state law in Israel that explicitly prevents equality for Israeli citizens by saying that only Jews have the right of self-determination in their country. So the 20% of Israelis who happen to be Palestinians are wiped out of the equation. The Trump administration has supported anti-BDS legislation. Trump, of course, signed his executive order just a couple of weeks ago demanding that a thoroughly false definition of anti-Semitism that basically equates criticism of Israel with being anti-Semitic is now the position of the Trump administration and the executive branch of the U.S. government. So we could go on and on. Those are the biggest ones. And that's all before the announcement of this new agreement that's been reached between the U.S. and Israel. What it probably includes, there have been leaks and there's sort of assumptions about what's likely to be in there, it probably includes the acceptance of Israeli annexation of the Jordan Valley first, which is about 30% of the West Bank. It's already functionally annexed because virtually the entire Jordan Valley has now been labeled a closed military zone by the Israeli military, and most Palestinians, even those who own land there, are not allowed to enter. So it's already essentially annexed. It will probably include acceptance of Israeli sovereignty over all of the illegal settlements. It will include full Israeli control over all of Jerusalem, although perhaps some villages outside of Jerusalem, Abu Dis and others that have long been talked about by Israel as, oh, well, we can have a Palestinian capital in Abu Dis, and we'll call it Jerusalem. You know, it's sort of like saying we'll have a capital in San Bernardino, and we'll call it Los Angeles. You know, it doesn't quite work. It will probably include an acceptance of permanent Israeli security control of all of the West Bank. It will almost certainly do nothing about the fact that Gaza remains what the United Nations said 4 years ago, that in 2020, which is now, Gaza would be uninhabitable, and Gaza will likely remain uninhabitable, cut off from the West Bank, cut off from the outside world, under Israeli siege. Some small economic bones will be thrown, something like the Maquiladora factories on the U.S.-Mexico border. And crucially, I think one thing that is likely to be included is that there will be reference to this being the end of the conflict. And it's very important language, because what it references is not that this means the end of occupation or the end of apartheid, the end of inequality. Quite the contrary, it means the end to the right to resist. So that anyone, once an agreement like this is reached, although of course the Palestinians are not part of it, it means that there is no more complaining to be allowed, that this is now going forward what exists. And anyone who raises objections is somehow outside of normal discourse, would be called a terrorist, presumably, and that there is no longer any legitimate way to challenge this. So there will be no Palestinian rights. There was a statement yesterday from Trump where he said, well, there's no deal without the Palestinians, but if they don't sign, life goes on. The problem is that for Palestinians, life doesn't always go on. People are dying from lack of medical care in Gaza, being shot on the Gaza, near the Gaza-Israeli fence by Israeli sharpshooters, raids going on, the arrest of children in the West Bank. All of this is continuing. There will be certainly no Palestinian state, but more crucially in some ways, there will be no Palestinian rights, and it will change the situation in that sense. It's certainly possible we may see some international opposition. It will be only a few small verbal statements, maybe from the Europeans, maybe, I don't know who else, the United Nations may say something, because it will almost certainly not include a call for a two-state solution. We do know that a two-state solution is no longer a possibility anyway. It's been made impossible by the Israeli land seizures, land confiscations. There's simply no land left for a Palestinian state. So whatever anybody thinks of whether a Palestinian state in only 22% of historic Palestine is legitimate or not, it's really not possible anymore. So it doesn't really matter whether it says it or not. It isn't going to happen. I think that what is important here is that this, again, is not an agreement between Israelis and Palestinians. The Palestinians have refused to engage on it for all the obvious reasons. They know what's in it. They know what the purpose of it is. The purpose is domestic political purposes in the interests of keeping Trump and Netanyahu in office, out of jail, not impeached. And those are the factors that are driving it far more than anything that remotely resembles an Israeli-Palestinian justice and peace.
Yeah, and Phyllis Bennis, all of this within the context of really trying to silence anybody talking about the conditions that Palestinians are living under. I mean, you mentioned increasingly the criminalizing people. If you dare to criticize Israel, then you have the label of being anti-Semitic slapped on you. That happened with Jeremy Corbyn, who was the labor leader in the UK and lost very badly in the last election there. So we see it happening on both sides of the pond. And
we do. I think that it's important, though, to recognize, you're absolutely right, Margaret, that the move towards criminalization, escalating these attacks on student activists in particular, are going on, and it's very dangerous for students that can be quite vulnerable. But it's also, I think, important for us to keep in mind that the reason they're clamping down like this, the reason that we're seeing Zionist organizations, pro-Israeli organizations lashing out like this is because they're getting increasingly desperate because they're losing support. All of the polls indicate it, that it's now a very much partisan issue in a way that support for Israel was always the ultimate bipartisan consensus in Washington. It still is to a large degree in Washington, but it no longer is bipartisan among voters. So the percentages, 60-70% of Democrats who do not support Israeli moves, do not support the new anti-BDS legislation, it's quite powerful. There's a real schism not only between Democratic and Republican voters, but between Democratic members of Congress who kind of didn't get the memo of where their base is and their base. So that's important. They're particularly concerned, I think, about losing the support of young Jews. You have organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, which I'm very proud to serve on the national board of. You have organizations like If Not Now and others of young Jews that are flocking to these anti-occupation, in some cases anti-Zionist organizations, that are looking to challenge the notion that somehow being Jewish means supporting Israel. And young people in huge numbers are saying, nope, that's not my understanding of what it means to be Jewish. Being Jewish means a certain set of you know, cultural stuff and a certain set of moral commitments. It does not mean supporting a state that imprisons children and that legislates inequality and that shoots unarmed protesters. So I think that we're seeing an escalation in the response to a rising and growing and increasingly empowered movement that's underway in this country and globally as well.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And we know that certainly in the United States, but also in places like the UK, the Jewish community, they've had a history and culture of social justice, including in the civil rights movement and just about any movement one could name. But that's always downplayed. And the kind of divisions that there's an attempt to whip up, for example, between Black people and Jewish people in New York City, et cetera, downplaying that history and culture of social justice, while, you know, on the other hand, criminalizing those who speak out against the apartheid conditions of Palestinian people. But you're absolutely right. That movement is coming up. And this is part of why all of this is happening. And also, I don't know if you had a quick comment on Israel officially allowing Israelis to travel to Saudi Arabia, because it does seem as though Trump, he's really now depending on Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf states to help to keep the Palestinians in line, even as this movement, as you say, among Jewish people themselves are busting out against these Israeli policies. Just some final thoughts.
That's certainly true. I think that the question of the Israeli relationship with Saudi Arabia is a bit more complicated, because much of it is driven at the elite levels, where governments on both sides have really wanted for a long time to go public with their existing but covert cooperation and collaboration, particularly in the context of the anti-Iran coalition that the U.S. has been building in the region. Jared Kushner is not only, Trump's son-in-law, is not only the key architect, allegedly, of this so-called deal of the century, he's also the architect with his other crown princes. It's like a little team of crown princes, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia and the crown prince of the UAE, along with Jared Kushner, have been this little gathering of the princes in the region to try and figure out how they can normalize this relationship between Israel and the Gulf Arab monarchies in the interest of mobilizing against Iran. So in that context, the governments have wanted to do that. They want to have trade. They want to normalize. The government of Saudi Arabia could care less about Palestinian rights. They could care less about the rights of their own people, for that matter.
That's right.
But in this case, what they're using this as a way that it's what they call an outside-inside strategy. It was similar to what George Bush Sr. tried in 1991 in Madrid. The theory of, if you bring a bunch of Arab countries to explicitly normalize relations with Israel, the Palestinians will have no choice but to follow along, rather than the idea of starting from the inside. You get the Israelis and Palestinians together and then eventually win over the Arab states. Neither one works, because both of them, from the U.S. vantage point, was always based on privileging Israel. And in that context, it's not going to work here either. The Palestinians are not going to suddenly fall into line with this deal because a small number of Palestinian citizens of Israel who are Muslims are suddenly allowed to enter Saudi Arabia for the Hajj.
Yeah.
Whether they would anyway, whether the Saudis would even let them in, not clear. But this is not about trying to be nice to Palestinians under Israeli jurisdiction who happen to be Muslim and want to go to Saudi Arabia.
Right. Well, Phyllis Bennis, it remains to be seen. We'll know a bit more likely in a couple of hours, but I'm sure your assessment, your analysis is spot on this. Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much for breaking this all down for us. We appreciate
you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And coming up, the latest and some analysis on the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. And also, Baird Rustin, who played a critical role in the civil rights movement, including being one of the key organizers of the historic 1963 March on Washington, a confidant of Martin Luther King, but very much on the sidelines. Some say that part of that is because he was gay. So, and now there is a move for a stamp honoring Baird Rustin, and a lot more to learn about that. So stay with us. We'll be right back. And Peter Tosh, come together. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Our handle on Instagram and Twitter, at So True Radio. We're also on SoundCloud, and in our tradition, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Kalua, Kona, Hawaii. And internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in London, England. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're now going to turn our attention to the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. On Tuesday, January 28th, Donald Trump's defense team is set to finish its third and final day of oral arguments as part of his ongoing impeachment trial, which began earlier this month. Of course, you may recall his impeachment came after an official House investigation found that he had solicited foreign interference in the 2020 U.S. presidential election to help his re-election bid, basically finding dirt on Biden that he is assuming will be his opponent, and later obstructing the inquiry itself by telling his aides to ignore subpoenas for documents and testimony. Now, today, Trump's legal team is expected to claim that the House made an inaccurate case and the Senate shouldn't bolster it by hearing new evidence. But then on Sunday, January 26th, former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton, he has written a book. There's been a lot talked about that book. And part of Bolton's book, part of the manuscript, became public. And in it, Bolton says that Trump refused to release military aid for Ukraine until the country provided the information he was demanding on his political rivals. This, according to the New York Times, this is being treated as a bombshell. Before we welcome our guests, let us go now to a clip from CBS News on this.
Republicans face growing pressure to call witnesses in the president's impeachment trial after reports of explosive allegations from former National Security Advisor John Bolton in his upcoming book. Some in the GOP who had expressed their openness to calling witnesses are now doubling down on that view, while others still appear to be very unmoved. Nancy Cordes is on Capitol Hill with more on this story. Nancy, realistically, what are the chances you think that John Bolton will, in fact, testify?
Well, Gail, if you just look at the math, we're now just one senator away from having the votes that Democrats need in order to bring Bolton in to testify. They've got three Republicans. They're looking for one more. This Bolton firestorm ignited a huge controversy here on Capitol Hill right in the middle of the trial, but it went largely unmentioned by the president's defense team.
There was cause to raise the issue about the Bidens and Burisma.
The president's legal team focused its defense yesterday on presidential candidate Joe Biden.
After Vice President Biden was made U.S. point man for Ukraine, his son Hunter Biden ends up on the board of Burisma.
It wasn't until the final hour of arguments that John Bolton's name even came up.
Nothing in the Bolton revelations, even if true, would rise to the level of an abuse of power or an impeachable offense.
According to the New York Times, Bolton, in his upcoming book, says that President Trump directly conditioned military aid to Ukraine on an investigation into the Bidens. And while some Republicans shrugged that revelation off,
I think it's going to vindicate the president.
Democrats say the information Bolton has is more crucial than ever.
First-hand knowledge mandates that we hear from.
All righty. I'd now like to welcome our guest, John Boniface, co-founder and president of Free Speech for People. He previously served as the executive director and then general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute, an organization he founded in 1994, as the legal director of Voter Action, a national election integrity organization. He has been at the forefront of key voting rights battles in the U.S. for more than two decades, pioneering a series of court challenges. And also, he served as co-counsel in international human rights and environmental litigation, including litigation to hold the Chevron Texaco oil company accountable for its widespread destruction of the Ecuadorian Amazon. So a lot of experience there on voting rights, as well as the environment. Good things to bring together. John Boniface, welcome.
Having me.
Okay, so your analysis on what is happening now, because what do you think the impact of this bombshell of Bolton's book will be? You know, we're hearing now that some Republicans are moving in the direction of calling witnesses, but then there's also this business about some behind the scenes negotiation, a kind of a tit for tat of perhaps calling some of the witnesses that Republicans want.
Yes, well, we have to start with the basic premise that there is no such thing as a trial without witnesses, without demanding documents. This will be a kangaroo court, a complete sham, if there are no witnesses, if there is no demand for documents to demonstrate whether the president should be convicted. So that has to happen. And the people around this country who are calling Senate offices, who are showing up at Senate offices, who are showing up at the U.S. Capitol, we need to keep doing that because that's what's required for we the people to have our voices heard at this critical moment in history. The explosive story on Sunday, the New York Times reported, of John Bolton's manuscript only intensifies the pressure for that call for witnesses. And I think we are close to the point now where there will be four, maybe more, Republican senators who break from Mitch McConnell and this effort to have a cover-up and require witnesses to be called for this trial, joining the 47 Democrats who would vote that way. And there's only a 51-vote majority needed to demand witnesses and documents. But we shouldn't only focus on John Bolton. We should focus on Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, others who were directly knowledgeable of this conspiracy, this scheme to subvert the Constitution, which the president directed. And we should focus on the demand for documents, because documents do not lie. And, you know, we're at this critical moment in history because this president, on an almost daily basis, has attacked our Constitution, our democracy, and the rule of law, and he must be held accountable through this impeachment process.
Yeah. So what is your thought? I mean, do you think that the Democrats should go along with the idea that, well, we'll, if we agree that Bolton should be a witness, we want Biden or Biden's son? What is the advantage or disadvantage of the Democrats going along with that?
Well, first, obviously, if this were a court of law, only relevant witnesses would be allowed to testify. You can't just bring in a witness who knows nothing about the underlying charges and have that person put under direct or cross-examination on matters that are not relevant to the alleged crimes. Here, the alleged high crimes, the alleged offenses against the state, are, you know, directly associated with what John Bolton has to say, what Mick Mulvaney has to say, but are completely irrelevant to what Hunter Biden would have to say. He was not in the room with Donald Trump in any of these decisions. He doesn't have anything to say as to whether the president tied the withholding of military aid to Ukraine to the call for investigations of Joe Biden and his son. He has nothing to say on that. So it's a completely irrelevant witness, and I don't think that Democrats should be engaged in negotiating on that point, because it would undermine the very purpose of this trial. If, however, at the end of the day, Hunter Biden is called alongside the witnesses that Donald Trump that are clearly able to testify about Donald Trump's conduct here, you know, I think we will see how irrelevant he is to this process. He has nothing to say on this matter. Now, I heard former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi's presentation yesterday before the Senate, where she tried to focus all on Burisma and the Bidens. And let me just say, there's no question that at the very least there was an appearance of corruption associated with the vice president at the time, Joe Biden, having direct engagement and oversight over the policy, U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine, and his son serving on the board of Burisma. I accept and agree that that, from an appearance standpoint, is wrong, but that does not rise at anywhere level to the impeachable offenses we're talking here, number one. And number two, it's been fully investigated as to whether there was any actual corruption associated with that policy that Joe Biden directed for the Obama administration, and no evidence exists that there was any actual corruption involved. So Pam Bondi wants to distract the American people. Trump's defenders want to distract the American people from the underlying charges here, which is that this president subverted the Constitution for his own political gain.
Right. And what did you make of the rather lengthy intervention, one should say, defense of Alan Dershowitz? I wonder if you want to comment on Ken Starr's role as well.
Yeah. So first on Alan Dershowitz, Alan Dershowitz is a criminal defense attorney and law professor. He specializes in criminal defense law. He's not a constitutional law professor. That has to be stated at the outset. There are no reputable constitutional scholars in this country who agree with the premise that he put forward last night to the United States Senate that somehow, in order for there to be an impeachable offense, you must prove a crime under the federal statutory criminal code. That is just completely bogus. There's no such basis whatsoever for that argument from a constitutional perspective. James Madison spoke of a president being impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton talked about the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust, as being impeachable offenses, saying that they are political in nature. These are crimes against the state, abuse of power and abuse of the public trust. That's what impeachment is about. There was, in fact, very little under the federal criminal code at the time that there was a label of high crimes and misdemeanors. So bribery, treason, and other high crimes and misdemeanors does not apply to violation of the federal criminal code. That's not to say that some federal criminal violations can rise to be impeachable offenses, but there's no basis whatsoever to claim that you must prove first an underlying criminal violation in order to prove an impeachable offense. And, you know, one other point on this that needs to be remembered from the Nixon era is that, you know, that was also all about abuse of power. And then Congresswoman Barbara Jordan from Texas spoke eloquently before the House Judiciary Committee. She was a member of that Judiciary Committee during the Nixon Watergate era. And she said, if the impeachment provision in the Constitution of the United States will not reach the offenses charged here, then perhaps the 18th century Constitution should be abandoned to a 20th century paper shredder. We're now in the 21st century, and Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump want to abandon the Constitution to a 21st century paper shredder. And we cannot in any way give credence to Alan Dershowitz's specious claims that he made before the U.S. Senate. As for Ken Starr, you know, it's just deeply ironic that here is the special prosecutor, former special prosecutor during the Clinton era, who went before, with his report, went before the House representatives laying out the case for impeaching Bill Clinton on abuse of power, on these very kinds of arguments. And now he's claiming that somehow what Donald Trump is charged with doing has no basis whatsoever under the impeachment clause. There's absolute hypocrisy in what he's presenting here. And again, these are defenders of the president who do not want to go to the underlying charges, so they make specious claims from a constitutional perspective, or they distract entirely and want to talk about something else that has nothing to do with the charges at hand.
Right. And then Rudy Giuliani being thrown under the bus, you think?
Well, I think we will continue to see people who are toxic to the claims of somehow the president's innocence being thrown under the bus, and that includes Rudy Giuliani, and trying to pin it on him as if he's not doing this at the direction of the president. This is precisely why witnesses need to be called, why documents need to be demanded. And I would add, Lev Parnas needs to be brought in as well as among those witnesses, because he's come forward as an associate of Donald Trump's and Rudy Giuliani, telling a story that's very different than the way the president's defenders want it to be heard. So there is a lot more explosive evidence, frankly, to come forward that we have not heard, and that's precisely why we need to have a full and fair trial. At the end of the day, this president must be held accountable. He has been held accountable through the House and its impeachment process, and that will forever mark this presidency as well as future presidents. But we must not stop there, and we must demand a full and fair trial, and we must demand that the Senate carry out its duty to do impartial justice.
Well, John Boniface, thank you so much for helping to break this down for us. And we hope we can call on you again, because this is to be continued and may even run a bit longer than had been initially predicted. Thank you so much.
Yes, it may, and I'd be happy to come back. Thanks very much.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. For our last segment today, Bayard Rustin played a critical role in the civil rights movement, including being one of the key organizers of the historic 1963 March on Washington. He was a confidant and advisor to Martin Luther King, but mostly behind the scenes. Early in his life, while he was in college, he was a member of a Communist Youth League, and he was also gay, which many thought would be an embarrassment to Dr. King and to the civil rights movement. He was also arrested in Pasadena, California, for having sex in a car with a man. Bayard Rustin, over his adult life, was arrested several times for his civil rights and human rights work, including working on a chain gang during one of those arrests. But in his later years, our critics said he increasingly moved to the right. He split with Martin Luther King over King's opposition to the Vietnam War. He also became a supporter of Israel at a time when, as is today, Israeli policies against Palestinian people are being equated to apartheid-like conditions. He also promoted elections as a strategy moving forward for the civil rights movement, which caused some in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to be upset, because they were promoting black power and black autonomy and didn't trust the electoral politics or the democratic processes practiced in the United States. But in 2013, President Barack Obama bestowed on Bayard Rustin, who was still dubbed a convicted felon, the Presidential Medal of Honor. This helped to thrust Bayard Rustin back into the political discourse, including addressing the issues of homophobia in black communities. And now there's a movement to recognize him for his contributions to the civil rights movement and also as a gay rights activist. In 2019, the California legislature passed a joint resolution in support of the National Bayard Rustin Stamp Campaign. And here to discuss all of this with us, I'd like to welcome Lauren Buisson, who is the West Coast Director director of the National Baird Rustin Stamp Committee, overseeing social media communication strategy and political lobbying in the Western states on behalf of the international court system. She's a journalist by training and was the chief writer and contributor to the 2018 political podcast, Stonewall Spotlight. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Yeah, I wanted to play some of a clip of Baird Rustin. We have amazing clips of him, by the way, in the Pacifica Radio archives. If you don't have them, you should get them. Tell us what, you know, about this stamp campaign. And since the 2019 move, the resolution in the legislature, what support have you picked up?
Well, stamps, despite what we've been told that people no longer write letters, are a profound way that we commemorate an individual's achievement in the history and service to our nation. And the fact that Baird has been so long obscured from the history of this country, you know, means that we need more education about the stamp. When the stamp is released, you not only get the stamp, but you get a complete rollout, often aimed at the schools, which helps to jumpstart the re-examination of this figure's importance through our school system and through our children. The 2019, for me, was a culmination in a lot of hard work that started actually with an off-chance speech that I gave about Baird's contributions, and then was heard by a city council person, Monica Rodriguez, who took it forward and got a supporting resolution for the city council. Now, what this meant was I suddenly realized that there were a lot of major players in Los Angeles who were players in the Democratic Party and also had connections in Washington. And so I started to go bit by bit to through the county, through Hilda Solis, for example, who was a former Secretary of Labor under President Obama, and it turned out a great admirer of Baird Rustin. And so where we are today, actually, is with a movement. We're getting a lot of synergy. Every holiday that now celebrates Martin Luther King and also the March on Washington is remiss if people don't mention Baird's contributions. And we were really thrilled, I was really thrilled, that on the anniversary of his passing, Congresswoman Karen Bass, who, as you know, is the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, endorsed our campaign.
Oh, yes, that's really incredible news. I mean, a lot of people know so little about him and about his contributions over the years, of course, that somewhat colored by positions he took later in life. People may not realize that he was a Quaker, a pacifist, and that he played a key role in the Montgomery bus boycott led by Rosa Parks. Martin Luther King became a spokesperson, you know, for that. And also his work with the A. Philip Randolph Committee Against Discrimination in the Armed Forces, which really forced Truman's order to eliminate segregation in the armed forces. So, and there's a lot more that could be said about him that we don't have the time right now to say. So is your hope that this campaign itself and having that stamp, that a lot more of that information in terms of his contributions, in particular to the civil rights movement, but also the persecution that he suffered because he was a gay man, would come to the fore? Lauren Buisson.
Yes, that is exactly what we're hoping. The campaign was originated by the International Court. These are the same, this is the same all volunteer organization that was able to shepherd the Harvey Milk stamp into through the process and into production. Now, one thing that's important about Baird is that, as you mentioned at the start, was the fact that he was a Quaker. He was raised in the Quaker faith, and his grandmother, the woman who raised him, was not only a Quaker, but she was the head of her local NAACP chapter. And so the marriage of Quaker faith and pacifism to social activism was inculcated in Byard when he was really young. Byard was the first to say that, as he, paraphrasing here, gays were the new blacks, which is to say that he saw a connection between every civil rights movement, every step forward for one group would ipso facto be part of an elevation of another. And one of the things that I thought was always very forward-thinking about him was that he said that the gays as a movement couldn't just fight for themselves, but they had to fight for the next group that was disenfranchised. And I like to think right now the people that Byard Rustin would be really advocating for are our homeless and our immigrant, especially our asylum-seeking brethren.
Yeah, right. Well, for people who want to support your efforts and this national movement, really, what should they do?
Well, the first thing I would recommend is that your listeners contact their local, their congressional representative. There is a bill before the Congress. Now, keep in mind that the Stamp Committee is independent, but having a bill go through Congress, especially the House, puts that request at the top of the list, right? So I know from my one of my early endorsers, which was the local committee on justice and peace, which is a consortium of faith leaders, that this is now before the committee, that they are looking at the Byard-Rustin stamp. They got that confirmed in writing.
Okay.
And so people can call their congressional reps and please just ask them to support Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton's H.R. 1537, which is to tell the post office, now's the time to issue a Byard-Rustin stamp.
Right. Well, Lauren Buisson, thank you so very much and wish you all the best with your efforts. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All righty. We are out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our Sojourner Truth team, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, our engineer, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
I don't care where you bury my body, my soul is gonna live with God.
Meet me, Lord.